Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Patty Whipfler has worked with parents and their children for 4 decades, and during that time she's developed a simple but powerful parenting approach that she says promotes optimal child development. She'll share some of those with us today around 12:40. I'm very pleased, first of all, to welcome Mary Ellen Hannibal. She is a returning guest with her latest book. And you know, last time I spoke with her, she was down in Mexico after writing The Spine of the Continent. Her latest book, released just this month, is Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. And Mary Ellen is an award-winning environmental journalist. She's a Stanford Media Fellow, and her works appeared in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and Esquire, as well as many other publications. Mary Ellen Hannibal, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm just so happy to be speaking with you again.
Yes, we're glad to have you back. And this, as I was saying before we started, is a really great book. I want to just lead into this. You know, last year I talked with Paul Ehrlich, a senior fellow by courtesy at Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. He's also the Bing Professor of Population Studies there. And he said there's little doubt that the sixth mass extinction is here. Species are disappearing faster than since the dinosaurs' demise. But he also offered hope, and I know you talk a lot about this in your book. So let's begin with how you describe your book, because it is about environmental issues and people who are making a difference, but it's also part memoir, and of course you talk a lot about citizen science. So how do you describe the book?
Well, Vicki, as you know from reading both The Spine of the Continent and from this book, one of the kind of task that I set myself as a writer is to bring science, you know, hardcore science information to people in a different context, in a way that's easier for us to absorb into our regular lives, into narratives that we can relate to. So the Citizen Scientist book is personal. You know, I always put myself usually in my narratives when I'm reporting, just so I can kind of take the reader along with me, come along and learn with me. But in writing this book, my father died while I was writing it, and it was kind of an uncanny experience. He was 78, so it wasn't, you know, a terrible disaster that he died. It was fine, really. But he wanted to be read the short stories of Ernest Hemingway as he was dying. And I just had such an uncanny experience of some of the kinds of concepts that I was conveying in my book when I was writing it, what seemed to me completely personified and made concrete by Ernest Hemingway and my father. So there's a theme in my book about Joseph Campbell, who some listeners will remember is this world mythologizer who discerned the hero's journey in all world mythologies. And it, partly he's in my book because he was hugely influenced by Ed Ricketts, who was also very influential with John Steinbeck. And Ed Ricketts was an intertidal biologist, but not really. He was a citizen scientist, and yet he made absolutely foundational contributions to how we understand the intertidal today. But what Campbell got out of Ricketts was a sense of purpose and meaning through time, through myth and biology. He, for the rest of his life, he spent a year or so, a little less than a year, with Ricketts and Steinbeck. And for when they were very young, in their 20s, Ricketts was a bit older. But for the rest of his life, Campbell said Ed Ricketts was the start of it all.
Right.
And Ricketts really conveyed that myth is nature talking. This was what Campbell discerned. So, I mean, my book is very wide-ranging, as you can discern from me just having told you that much about it. I do focus a lot on the California and West Coast because that's where I live. Something that's very fundamental to citizen science is that it's place-based. But these days, we don't just exist in our own one place, although that's very important. that we know, you know, who lives here with us, who are the species coexisting on our landscapes, what are the kind of weather and climate patterns that are normal, quote unquote, for where we live, and how are they changing with climate change. But we're all global citizens now because the human impacts are such that it is literally one world. So one of the things that's exciting about citizen science is that it helps us kind of reconcile both our specificity, our local place, and our regional place. You know, for me, that would be coastal California in general, and then our continental place, you know, and things that are very relevant to the spine of the continent. My previous book, Remain, very relevant in this book about extinction.
And so let's just define, for those who are not at all familiar with this term, what you mean exactly by citizen science.
So simply put, citizen science is regular people contributing to scientific research, and it goes way, way back. So Charles Darwin was a citizen scientist. He did not have an advanced degree. He worked for no institution. Aristotle was a citizen scientist. He made direct observations of nature with no advanced degree. In my book, I have a big chapter on what's called traditional ecological knowledge, indigenous cultures, like California Indian tribes, have made direct observations of nature for millennia and applied their observations to the landscape in ways that are basically scientific. So citizen science today is relevant because we are in this extinction crisis and we need all the help we can get, and also because of smartphone technology. So with your smartphone, you can use apps and access databases where you can become like Darwin, you can become like Lewis and Clark, you can become like John Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts, you can be an explorer of the world. And when you make observations of nature with some of these apps, you can also contribute to scientific research that's being done all around the world. It's absolutely amazing, and it's exciting, and it's very positive.
Right, and you say that I don't want to put people to sleep by mentioning big data, but what makes today's citizen science real science is big data. It's accessible via the apps that people are collecting and filling out their apps, and that's how it's become real science.
Yes, and big data is actually pretty interesting because, you know, our problems today are global and they're huge. You know, we have to try to understand how nature works at these vast scales, which we really can't do. Scientists can't do it on their own. So big data allows them to really amass observations of nature over time and over huge geographical areas. So eBird, for example, is kind of the granddaddy of citizen science platforms. And eBird is run by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And they have collected more than 200 million observations of birds around the world.
Wow.
With eBird.
Wow.
So with that kind of data, what you get is an ability to see patterns that you couldn't see without it. And now some people will say, oh, citizen science isn't real science, and it is real science. But one way to look at it is a bit different than hypothesis-driven experimental science. Instead of starting with a needle and then discerning the haystack, with big data science, you start with the haystack. And you don't ask yourself, is there a needle in it? Because you don't want to ask yourself about the pattern you're going to find. You want to be able to look at that haystack and then see what the pattern is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about probability and statistics and making, you know, future guesses that are based on the best possible knowledge. I mean, they're not guesses. That's a misleading word. But it is looking into the future, and we need to do that because global change is impacting us with great velocity. You know, our temperatures, as we all know, have gotten hotter than even the worst predictions, and they might still be, you know, accelerating. We don't know what we're in for here, and even if we get a huge handle on carbon dioxide emissions, we still have this problem with losing species at a rate and magnitude that took out the dinosaurs. And it's really at the species level, I think, that we can make a lot of contributions as individuals, because it's not just the polar bear and the lion that are going extinct in these far-off places, although they are, and we should do what we can to really try to prevent that. But we're losing vast numbers of animals and plants right in our own backyards.
Yeah.
So, you know, we know about the bee colony collapse and the vast reduction of monarch butterflies. These are things we can actually really observe up close and personal. And when we do it using databases that are set up, we can help scientists and natural resource managers figure out the patterns of loss and then make strategic decisions about how to support those populations. And, for example, with bees and butterflies, we can plant habitat for them at strategic locations and really, really help their populations.
Yeah, it's amazing what's right here in our backyard. You know, I went whitewater rafting just over a week ago. I was the only person booked for that particular trip on the Tyerton River. But so they sent three guides out with me to balance the boat, you know. And so it was great because I had all these this great information. And one of them had just taken a raft full of bird watchers out. I forget the technical name for them. But during the time they were out, they spotted 43 species in about, as I think it was a 13-mile river trip.
So isn't that amazing?
It's quite amazing, yeah. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, lots more questions for you, Mary Ellen.
Great. Thanks, Vicki.
My guest is Mary Ellen Hannibal, and her book is called Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
It's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just going to keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Broaden your horizons. You'll be amazed at all the topics we cover on Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we're talking today with award-winning environmental journalist and Stanford Media Fellow Mary Ellen Hannibal. Her latest book is called Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. It's a lot of science in here that connects with laymen like me. It's also part memoir and adventure. So I want to ask you, because you talked in the beginning and you introduced them very early in the book, Darwin and Joseph Campbell. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. But you say that Darwin personifies the hero's journey, which, of course, Joseph Campbell put together and made very well known. So tell us why Darwin personifies the hero's journey, if you would.
So that's such a fun question. Thank you for asking it. Well, as Joseph Campbell pointed out, the hero's journey starts with our person, a young man or woman, heading out to live their own life. And they heed a call, and the call, and then there's sort of a moment where they don't really accept the call, and there's sort of a timeout. Then the hero decides to actually go on the journey and is really departing from all the known world and the known community that that person is from. And then there's a series of adventures along the way, and the hero goes through various self-transformations, but then comes back to his or her original community or tribe with new information or some kind of new insight that is useful for everybody, that helps everybody else. So Darwin personifies this in many ways. We can start with the end of his journey, which is arguably still unfolding with Darwin. Many people will say that Darwin is, you know, probably one of the most important thinkers who ever lived. And, you know, Alfred Russel Wallace also deserves credit with Darwin for figuring out that natural selection was the process by which evolution occurs. So this is the mystery of mysteries. How does new life appear on Earth? And today that question is, you know, hugely important because we're terminating life forms kind of willy-nilly with the extinction crisis. Extinction is a natural part of how things go here, but it's happening too fast. But Darwin came to become this incredible thinker in a very roundabout way. He was not a very good student. He was kind of online to become a minister, and he was just sort of not. He didn't really have any direction in life when he was young, and he was sent when he got out of college to go and keep company with the depressive Captain Fitzroy of the Beagle. And the Beagle left England and took this worldwide journey to develop navigational maps, which were actually, they were so well made in the end that they were used until World War II. So they were used for almost 100 years for the British Navy to navigate. But it was when Darwin was Darwin was watching and noticing, and he didn't have anything in mind. I'm not going to figure out how life occurs. But he started to really notice things when he was aboard the Beagle, especially when he got to the Galapagos. So he noticed very importantly that the life forms he saw in the Galapagos were the same but different than those on the mainland coast of Ecuador. Mm. And Alfred Russel Wallace also figured this out at the same time. And what they really both understood is that new life forms arise out of previous ones when populations become separate from each other, but the new population has enough numbers and enough resources to keep going on with life and doesn't become extinct, and then develops new traits in accordance with their new environment. So this very fundamental insight into how new life forms occur is really, it is the blueprint for what we call conservation biology today, and which is really the science of saving nature. And then conservation biology, in turn, really gives marching orders to citizen science. So Darwin's insights about how life originates are actually still reverberating out, even into today's citizen science.
Mm.
He went back. It took him many years of painstaking documentation, analysis, comparisons to come up with his theory. He didn't publish it until he was in his 50s, or 50. And so that was like 25 years or so of thinking about things. So his journey was this long process of not knowing where it would lead, and yet coming up with, at this critical juncture, with this vital piece of information to give back to the rest of us. But Vicki, you know, another thing that I really came to me while I was writing Citizen Scientist is that the hero's journey is also personified by many other species. I realized looking at a map of OR7, do you know that wolf that came from Oregon and came down into California and then
yes.
went back up into Oregon?
Yes.
You can look at OR7's journey, and it's a circle. So the journey is, wolves do this, right? They leave their natal home. They light out for the territory. They're going to find a mate and to establish a new territory. And then at the end of their journey, they do establish a new territory, and they have a new wolf pack.
Mm-hmm.
And this cycle is completed in many ways. You can think of birds as completing a hero's journey. They make a big circumambulation around the world, many of them, and they are bringing nutrients to different parts of the world where, you know, they're doing this vast nutrient exchange that the rest of us really depend on.
Yes.
So the hero's journey really does, I mean, I don't think Campbell understood that there was this really physical part of what the hero's journey could be said to describe, but he would have kept up with the scientific reading and he would have figured it out by now if he was still alive. He died in like 1989, and it's really been more, it was after that that science has really been figuring out how animal movement and transferring energy around the globe helps creates clean air, clean water, food, and a habitable atmosphere.
Yeah, I actually think the hero's journey applies to most things in life, in a different way maybe, but it definitely does.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. You say in the book, because you end with your talking a little about your father's death, and you say that you thought about what Joseph Campbell said there too, that the hero's death is the most important part of his journey. What did you take away from that, Mary Ellen?
Well, that's such a wonderful to the heart of everything question, Vicki, so thank you so much for asking it. You know, I had time as my father was dying to kind of be thinking about what was happening. And I was, of course, thinking about extinction. I was thinking about writing. My father was a writer. I was thinking about everything he had done for me and given to me in my life. And Joseph Campbell did say that the most important moment of the hero's journey is his death or her death. And one of the things he meant by that was that when you die with kind of awareness and you are letting go and you actually do allow yourself to die, you are accepting that you're part of nature and you're going back into the carbon cycle, as it were. Your that soul or whatever it is, who you are, those carbon molecules are going to start breaking apart and you're going to start becoming, you know, earth, sun, sand, and water again. And this was what I realized that my father was giving to me, was I was experiencing putting myself in alignment with nature by accepting his death and also by accepting my own place kind of in the generational trajectory, you know, that much closer to being the older generation myself, although mm-hmm. my mother is still alive. And that was the profundity for me of, and also just the bearing witness that this is what you do as a citizen scientist. You observe, you know, you bear witness to other species and you take note of them. And my father always, he loved to hear me tell tales about the hawk watch, watching the hawks fly by. And he thought that was really a spiritual kind of paradigm of watching these hawks fly by. They fly across the Golden Gate Gateway, now across the Golden Gate Bridge every fall. Right now is the peak of the raptor migration happening right now. And they've done that for millions of years. And just the observation of that species doing it this year puts me in line with understanding the very long time frame. And so I accept, in a sense, my own passing as I accept the passing of the birds.
Right. I could really connect with you on that. I know you talked about sometimes you'd said, I think it was to your brother, you know, was that dad when the hawk goes by. But there's that connection there because I was raised with that whole, you know, nature thing about death and it's part of nature. And I know when my own father died, he said right at the very end, OK, let's hurry up and let's get this last part done with.
Wow. Yes, well, my brothers, that right when my father died, they kept having hawk sightings. This was on the East Coast. And they said, oh, you know, this hawk came and sat down on a telephone pole and squawked at me. I think it was Dad. And I kept saying, no, it's not Dad. It's a hawk.
Right, right.
don't burden the hawk with Dad's life. But in thinking about why we're so eager, you know, I had a friend, I actually really kind of, I was a little appalling in this sense. She said, oh, you know, I know that my mother, very soon after her death, she appeared in a butterfly form right at the funeral. And I said, really? And she said, yes, we were sitting around a table outside and a butterfly flew down right at the moment when someone was talking about my mother. And I said, well, you know, was there a flower arrangement on the table? Because, you know, we want to see meaning in the natural world that connects with the people that we love and also with what we can't see anymore when they're gone. And I really have deep sympathy with that. But I also feel like it's very important to really honor that the animals are themselves and they're not just carriers for our own feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So as long they let's let them provoke us into really respecting life in a bigger level, but not burden them with carrying the souls of us.
Okay.
They have their own souls.
Right. I think it's a coping mechanism for many. I do understand that. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the heroes you found along. We won't have very long, but we'll talk about some of the heroes you found along the way.
And okay, great.
What was heartening? You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Coming up next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, author Jane Allison discusses her new release, Nine Island. Evocative, sad, at times funny, and never completely without hope. It's a story that explores what it means to be alone later in life. Tune in Mondays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and 98.9 HD Channel 3.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Ananda Institute of Living Yoga, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 2nd, it's Shelter, Rescue, Sanctuary, and Anything That Helps Our Animal Friends Sunday. We'll check in with local shelters and rescues to find out how they're doing and what kind of help they need. Plus, Friends of Woodland Park Zoo Elephants, Aline Fortgain, will join us with all the latest details about our beloved bamboo. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, I found a toy dinosaur over on the playground by Smith Street. It had this phone number on it, and, well, I just wanted to make sure the dinosaur made it back to its little owner.
When I found the little sippy cup, I just had to give you a call. It's for a kid, you know?
I know my son gets super attached to the smallest things, even a fire truck, and I'd be happy to drop it off.
We'd do anything for kids, yet 1 in 5 children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. Help end childhood hunger near you. Learn how at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Get your daily dose of variety. Alternative Talk, 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Mary Ellen Hannibal. Her adventure of exploration and discovery was kickstarted by the sudden loss of her father, and we've talked a little about that. It prompted her to examine her own past and contemplate the larger loss of species taking place all over the world. And the subtitle of the book is called Citizen Scientist, the subtitle, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. And as we said before, it's part memoir, but there's a lot of science in here. I want to ask you about a couple of the heroes that you ran into along the way. Just ordinary people doing citizen science. Who was the one person who just really caught your attention as doing something really extraordinary? They're all doing extraordinary work, but was there one connection in particular?
Well, I would call out Val Lopez, who's the chair of the Amamutsin Tribal Band in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So this tribal band has no federal recognition, and many of the Amamutsin descendants today are very, very poor and have a very hard life. And Val has been working with UC Berkeley researchers. This is a category of citizen science sometimes called extreme citizen science because it's the questions that are being asked are driven by a community, the people themselves, rather than a question being asked by a scientist, although scientists or PhDs are helping them answer it. And what Val and other people that are doing similar work are focused on is recovering their traditional ecological knowledge. Here in California, a lot of that has to do with burning, with actual lighting of low-intensity fires to manage the landscape. And the landscape on the West Coast evolved with fire, and many of our woes today, the drought and our huge, outrageous wildfires, are the direct result of suppressing that fire.
Right.
But the true cultivation, so Val would constantly say to me, Mary Ellen, you keep talking science, but it's not science that we're doing here. We're talking stewardship. We're talking caring for the earth and reestablishing our right human relationship with nature. And his dedication to doing this, and which has the work, by the way, has incredible implications for how we might go forward into the future, not depleting the natural world, but actually increasing its yields in a healthy way. It just has immense possibilities for solutions for all of us, not just for native people. And so he just the pure devotion to reestablishing our right relationship with nature by a person who really, it's not, he's not going to get anything more out of it in terms of, you know, he's never going to get money or position out of doing this. It's
right.
Just, he knows it's the right thing to do.
Right. And where did you find hope? Where and how did you find it? Maybe in places that you didn't expect to find it.
Well, the one thing I should mention is really that this big data part of citizen science, this capacity, another person to call out is Rebecca Moore, who invented Google Earth Outreach, basically. And you can go on Google Earth, you can just type in Google Earth Outreach and see some of the projects that she's fostering all over the world. But you can also make your own with the data. She's made all of these tools available free right there on your computer. Another place you can do a similar thing is called ESRI, E-S-R-I, and you can type in ESRI Story Maps. So using these technologies that are free and accessible, you can actually start to put data into maps and visualize what your landscape is meaningful to you, what is valuable to you. So an example is on the north coast of Victoria, some native tribes are using Google Earth Outreach to record tribal elders' stories about places and to record and to put into the map where traditional fishing grounds are. So what they're doing there is now creating a database so that when oil companies come to them and want to drill there, they have this database to say, well, you can't drill here because these are important for these cultural and other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that we can do everywhere. You can do that if you're in a city. If the people of Flint, Michigan had been able to be monitoring their water quality and putting it on a map of their water system, if they had known that they could have done that, then they would have had a database to go to the local authorities and say, look, you need to do something about our infrastructure.
That's an excellent example. That's an excellent example.
And that's, you know, we should all start documenting everything about where we live because as we're going forward, all of these environmental pressures are just going to be bigger and we're all going to have to cope with you know, things going downward for all of the kinds of qualities that we take for granted. So we need to be able to have the data in hand to go to the officials and say, we need to do something about this.
Right. It does put a whole new spin on big data. I deal with big data from a different perspective. This I could handle dealing with.
Yeah. This is where it matters to us personally, right?
It does. It matters to us personally. And so, yes, it does put a whole new spin on big data. So this is a big book. How long did it take you to write?
It took 4 years.
Did you were you going on your adventure as you wrote, or did you take notes and then write it all at once?
The writing took quite a long time, and I continued to research as I was writing.
Mm.
So it was supposed to take about 3 years, and instead it took 4. And part of that was a few realizations that I had of how I wanted to restructure the book. One big realization I had was that all of our environmental woes today kind of have a historical trajectory. You can make a kind of an originating moment on any landscape, but here on the west coast of North America, it's approximately 1769 when the Spanish made first contact with the natives. Now, that moment of contact and the eventual degradation of the landscape would go back earlier on the East Coast to when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. And it's really when the landscape started to be purposed in very, very efficient, short-term efficient ways, but just went crazy with resource extraction and turning wildlands into agriculture and human development. And so my book is, I think it's kind of almost an invisible structure, but I did lay out the stories that I tell mostly through a historical timeline. So I start with the sea star wasting that's going on right now off the coast.
Oh, starfish, as I call them.
Yes, you can call them starfish.
You talk about that in the book, yeah.
You're allowed. They're not actually fish. They're echinoderms.
Right.
But I thought that was very important when I realized it, because it's not that we're bad. We're not bad as people. We've developed our culture in a certain kind of way. And we've done that over a long period of time. And
right.
So I think it helps to try to envision the future, to look at the history and see how it came about that we've gotten into our dire straits.
Right. Well, I have to let you go in just a moment, but I can't let you go, Mary Ellen, without asking in just a couple of sentences, if you can, how this changed you. This was a monumental journey. How did it change you?
Well, Vicki, I have been changed by my very big green awakening, which has taken years to fully unfold and is still unfolding. I do wake up almost every night in the middle of the night thinking about how to get more people to understand what's going on. So I feel completely purpose-driven with this work and I think constantly how to better present the information so that people can receive it.
Yeah, it's your work is very, very accessible. The book is called Citizen Scientists Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. And I look forward to talking with you again, as I'm sure we will.
I hope so too.
You work on your next one. All right. Thank you so much for being with us, Mary Ellen. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
And I'm just going to let listeners know that you can see Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's coming to the town hall Tuesday, October 4th at 7:30 p.m. She'll be at Town Hall, Seattle. And on Wednesday at noon at the Butcher's Table, which apparently is a new restaurant and it has an author series there. So that's something to watch out for again. If you missed any of that, you can give me drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net and I'll make sure you have all of that relevant information. The book, Citizen Scientists Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. And you can find about more about Ellen, Mary Ellen, and the work that she's doing and her other books at maryellenhannibal.com. All right, we need to take a quick break. We'll be right back with our next guest.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Coming up next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, author Jane Allison discusses her new release, Nine Island. Evocative, sad, at times funny, and never completely without hope. It's a story that explores what it means to be alone later in life. Tune in Mondays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and 98.9 HD Channel 3.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Make us part of your daily routine. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. I'm enjoying my conversation today, sipping my cups of tea. And we're going to change gears totally. We're talking about a whole different subject. We're talking about parenting. Author and co-founder of HandInHandParenting.org is joining me. Patty Whipfler is her name. Her book is called Listen, Five Simple Tools to Meet Your Everyday Parenting Challenges. And just to give you a little bit more background on Patty, she's worked with parents and children for over 40 years. She founded the nonprofit Hand in Hand Parenting in 1989, and since then has sold almost a million copies of Listen to Children pamphlets that have been sold in many languages. She's led over 400 residential weekend workshops for families and professionals who work with parents. And she also continues to train hundreds of therapists, social workers, and parent educators in the U.S. and 10 other countries. So busy, busy lady. Patty Whipfler, welcome.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, let's dive into this because we don't have a whole heck of a lot of time here. But interesting because your parenting concept is a little different to some out there. So what would you say is the main difference?
Most parenting approaches are based on some version of offering children rewards and punishments. You know, sometimes it's the reward of a smile from you or praise from you. Sometimes it's, you know, a star chart on the refrigerator and a trip to the toy store. And on the other hand, you have, you know, sort of disincentives to be off track, you know, anything. I mean, and those range from the traditional spankings, which many of us got when we were children, to time out to, you know, just, you know, disapproval from parents and upset. And we think that these work marginally well for a little bit of time. But if you've got a child who dwaddles in the morning, you can give them, you know, 10 timeouts in a row on 10 different mornings, and they're still likely to dwaddle on the 11th morning. It doesn't really help children function better. It's just a way to get through the situation, you know, the best way a parent can figure out. And connecting with children and realizing that connection is, it's the factor that releases children's intelligence. It's like when children feel close and connected to their parents, they think well, they cooperate, they're interested in, you know, in doing the thing that will make the family go better. They can think about other people's feelings. You know, children really do well when they feel connected, and when they don't, they can't think, and that's when their behavior goes off track. So we're really trying to help parents figure out, or we're giving parents five simple tools for connecting well with their children, repairing those connections when they fray, because we get busy, and we're not there to connect with our children just because we have to make the dinner or get the beds changed or, you know, feed the dog.
Right.
And this kind of discombobulates a child's mind and sends them off to fighting with their brother or their sister or refusing the dinner that you've, you know, worked so hard to make. And when you connect with children, the interesting thing is, and it's not well understood, that if a child has gotten disconnected and doesn't feel like they're close to their parent momentarily, when you go back in to try to connect with warmth and caring and maybe a little listening, oftentimes children have to blast off the bad feelings that they got when they couldn't see that you were paying attention. And, you know, so children often need to laugh, they need to cry, they need to have a tantrum about the things that you say no to or about them needing to come to the table for dinner now. And if you listen to that rather than punish them again for now being emotional, if you listen to those feelings, don't judge them, but just allow them, you know, pay attention, get in close, you know, say, I know you don't want to come to dinner, sweetie, but it's time. And you leave time for that emotional unloading, children function better and better, and the things that they do that just don't make life go easily slowly but surely disappear, and you've got a brighter child, a child who really feels close to you, a child who's using their time more creatively, and a child who just doesn't get into trouble so often.
So it's a powerful idea. Yes, it's this connection. You talk about this. I was reading through the blog this morning, and you talk about connection all through. Every single problem that you can think of with a child begins with connection. And you talk a lot about listening. Are we not listening properly to our kids?
I think every parent listens as much as they can, but life is pressured and hard on parents. We don't give parents very much support, and
right.
Parenting is emotional work. And it takes emotional support to sort of refuel yourself so that you can really be there in a very present way for your child. So one of the listening tools is, you know, helping parents figure out how to listen to one another so that when they feel like having a tantrum, which is almost every day for most parents of young children, frankly, or when they feel scared about what their child is going through or worried about separating from their child, they have someone to go to and offload the feelings that they have so that, and without paying money, you know, two parents can support one another very, very well without professional training. You just, you know, there's some simple guidelines, and this gives parents emotional support. And when you have been listened to, you are a heck of a lot better at, you know, moving towards your child with some patience and some ability to listen.
Right. I see a lot of kids acting out very aggressively, certainly behavior that wouldn't have been tolerated by my parents or grandparents. But you say when a child is stuck in aggressive behaviors, he's gripped by some old fears or upset that got stuck in his limbic brain. How do we connect with that to change this aggressive behavior?
Well, aggression is a sticky one, so there's not just one strategy to use. Giving children a playful outlet for their aggression is very, very helpful. So we like to get parents doing, you know, little pillow fights or, you know, blowing up 10 balloons and having a big old balloon battle in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
And the child who is the most aggressive is the one who really needs you when they bop you with a balloon to fall over, when they, you know, when they hit you with a pillow, you fall over, you be the one that gets got. And this allows children to laugh and laugh and laugh. It encourages them. It makes them feel more powerful. It releases at least the top level of the fears that they're carrying that make them so impulsive and so hard on others at times when they feel scared. So that's one beginning strategy. The other one is simply bringing the limit, not saying the limit from 4 feet away. Don't pull your brother's hair, because when a child is headed to pull their brother's hair, they're already gone.
Right.
They cannot process what you're saying to them, which is why they never do. They can't. They are hobbled by the fear that has grabbed their mind and deprived them of their good judgment. So what you do is you just see them heading for their little brother, and you go, you get there first, and you go, uh-uh. And you offer eye contact, and you listen. And what will happen if you are quiet enough, if you are centered and offering listening and not offering a whole bunch of emotional stress yourself, they will have a big cry. And they might sweat, they might kick, they might stomp, they might, you know, be all over the place. those are the feelings coming out that drive your child to be aggressive. And when you can, you know, set limits so that they can't hurt you or anybody else while they're having a big tantrum cry, you get the most peaceful, thoughtful child afterwards. And we usually like to get parents doing both of those strategies, you know, playing, eliciting laughter, taking the less powerful role, and moving into set limits, and then doing what we call stay listening, which is really allowing children to have powerful feelings, to let powerful feelings out while you are there paying attention and, you know, just really listening, so that, because listening defangs the feelings that cause aggression. Listening helps the child feel closer to people so they don't want to hurt other people. It's really a very powerful remedy.
Mm. So, you know, listening takes patience, and mm-hmm. we all think we listen well, but I know when I first started doing radio 12 years ago, I realized I didn't listen quite as well as I thought I did. It's a constant practice. But let's look at this now from the parent's perspective, because it takes an inordinate amount of strength and balance to stay calm and to listen. What advice do you give parents when they're at their wits' ends? There's a blog in here where you say that this one woman's baby, she said, his needs nearly crushed me. And I'm sure many parents feel like that at times, that here's this needy thing that they can't seem to satisfy. So when they're in that state and, you know, they're trying to remember, okay, I need to connect, I need to listen, what are some tools that you can share with them to get to that point?
Well, there's the emergency drill that you do because you are beyond the beyond, and then there's the remedy, which comes in the week after you've hit the wall, so that you don't hit the wall again next Monday when it all, you know, comes down on your shoulders. So I think one of the things we recommend that seems to work pretty well is when you are, you know, you just don't have it anymore, lie down. You're in the kitchen, lie down on the kitchen floor. You're out on the porch where you wash your clothes, just lie down next to the washer. Just lie down. Don't try to be a parent. You've got to make sure your children aren't running out in the street into traffic. So, you know, that you need to make sure that they are safe. But if they are doing nutty stuff and you are, you know, you don't want to attack them, that sort of makes the whole problem worse. So, you know, if you lie down, oftentimes because you are not trying to be a parent anymore suddenly, you can actually feel the bad feelings inside of you and have a little cry. One mom, you know, who told us what happened, she lay down, and all of a sudden she started laughing so hard the tears started running down her face, and her children came around and looked, and they'd been fighting with each other over who was first and who was second, and they started laughing too, and it just kind of broke the spell of emotion that they were all caught in. So that's one way to kind of break the spell. But long range, we just recommend that parents, we tell in the book how to set up a listening partnership with another parent, what the basic guidelines are, and how to use it. And it changes everything about parenting to have someone you can talk to once a week, someone you can just really let down your hair with, someone you can give the lecture that you want to give your four-year-old that you know will, you know, not
right.
be understood.
Right.
Someone you can give that lecture to and take the heat off of you so that you can turn and be the parent that, you know, can reason their way through a situation well.
Right. I have a friend who said she's going to check out your website. I was talking to her because you have a ton of resources up there. You've got a lot of literature up there. You've got free podcasts up there. And my friend is actually a grandmother now, but she feels she didn't do a great job with her own kids, and so she wants to do a better job as a grandmother. Mm-hmm. I know you wrote this book. You keep saying we wanted the book to be, you know, XYZ, but you wrote this with, is it Tosha Shore? Am I saying,
uh-huh.
saying
Michael
it right?
Walker.
So you co-authored this with Tosha Shore, and the book is called Listen, 5 Simple Tools to Meet Your Everyday Parenting Challenges. What's a final, very quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I'd love to meet them, and I'm going to be up at Third Place Books in Lake Forest Park on Saturday next Saturday night at 6:30 for a book signing and a little talk. So it would be really fun to have people come out, you know, get a book, hear these ideas, and hear some good, great anecdotes. And I guess the last one is that there are 130 stories from parents from all over the world, actually, in all different kinds of economic circumstances and parenting circumstances, whose stories are, you know, sprinkled throughout the book. It's very rich in real stories written by real parents in real tough situations.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And that's Saturday, October 1st. And my guest, as I said earlier, Patty Whipfler. And you can find out more about her at handinhandparenting.org. We're right at the end of our show, so we have to run. I'll see you next week. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.